Section 2. Human Nature. Chapter 4. Why Don't We Give More? Read by Natalia Vodianova, a Russian model, philanthropist, entrepreneur, and public speaker.
The world would be a much simpler place if one could bring about social change merely by making a logically consistent moral argument. But it's clear that even people who believe that they should give more don't always do so. We've learned a lot in recent decades about the psychological factors that lead people to behave in various ways. Now it's time to apply some of that knowledge to our problem. Why people don't give more than they do, and what might lead them to give more? If everyday life has not already convinced you that there is a human tendency to favor our own interests, psychologists have set up experiments to prove it. For example, Daniel Batson and Elizabeth Thompson gave participants in an experiment tasks to assign themselves and another participant who was not present. One of the tasks was described as relatively interesting and included a significant benefit, while the other was described as boring and had no benefit. The participants were also told, most participants feel that giving both people an equal chance by, for example, flipping a coin, is the fairest way to assign themselves and the other participant the tasks. A coin was provided for that purpose. Nobody except the participant could see how the coin fell. Interviewed after they had assigned the task, all of the participants said that the most moral response was either to flip the coin or to give the more rewarding task to the other participant. Yet, about half chose not to flip the coin, and of those who did not use the coin, more than 80% gave themselves the more rewarding task. More remarkably, however, it seemed that on 85% of the occasions, when the coin was tossed, it landed on the side that assigned the more rewarding task to the person who tossed it. Yet we often do kind and generous things. The medical services of most developed nations rely for their blood supply on the altruism of ordinary citizens who donate their own blood to strangers. They give up their time and go through having a needle inserted in a vein and experience many find unsettling, for no reward except perhaps some juice and a cookie. They don't even get priority if they should need blood themselves. And when people say, without the slightest hesitation, that they would save the drowning child, they are probably telling the truth. So why don't we save children in developing countries if the cost of doing so is modest? Beyond the simple battle between selfishness and altruism, other psychological factors are at work, and in this chapter I will describe 5 of the most important ones. The identifiable victim. Researchers seeking to find out what factors trigger generous responses paid participants in a psychological experiment and then offered them the opportunity to contribute some of the money to Save the Children, an organization that helps children in poverty, both in the United States and in developing countries. One group was given general information about the need for donations, including statements like, "Food shortages in Malawi are affecting more than 3 million children." A second group was shown a photo of a 7-year-old Malawian girl named Rokia. They were told that Rokia is desperately poor and that her life will be changed for the better by your gift. The group receiving information about Rokia gave significantly more than the group receiving only general information. Then a third group was provided with the general information, the photo, and the information about Rokia. That group gave more than the group that had received only the general information, but still gave less than the group that had received only the information about Rokia. Indeed, even adding a second identifiable child to the information about Rokia, while providing no general information, led to a lower average donation than when only one child was mentioned. The subjects of the experiment reported feeling stronger emotions when told about one child than when told about two children. Another study produced a similar result. One group of people was told that a single child needed life-saving medical treatment, costing $300,000. A second group was told that 8 children would die unless they were given treatment that could be provided for all of them at a total cost of $300,000. Again, those told about the single child gave more. This identifiable victim effect leads to the rule of rescue. We will spend far more to rescue an identifiable victim than we will to save a statistical life. Consider the case of Jessica McClure, who was 18 months old in 1987 when she fell into a dry well in Midland, Texas. As rescuers worked for 2.5 days to reach her, CNN broadcast images of the rescue to millions of viewers around the world. Donors sent in so much money that Jessica ended up with what was reported to be a $1 million trust fund. Elsewhere in the world, unnoticed by the media and not helped by the money donated to Jessica, about 67,500 children died from avoidable poverty-related causes during those 2.5 days, according to UNICEF. Yet it was obvious to everyone involved that Jessica must be rescued, no matter what the cost. The same reaction led to the extraordinary efforts mentioned in the previous chapter to save the 12 boys and their coach trapped in a cave in Thailand. Similarly, we do not abandon trapped miners or lost sailors, even though we could save more lives by using the money spent on such rescues on making dangerous intersections safer. In providing healthcare, too, we will spend much more trying to save a particular patient, often in vain, than we are willing to spend promoting preventive measures that would save many people from becoming ill. The identifiable victim moves us in a way that more abstract information does not. But the phenomenon does not even require particular details about the person. People asked by researchers to make a donation to Habitat for Humanity in order to house a needy family were told either that the family has been selected or that the family will be selected. In every other detail, the wording of the request was the same. In neither case were the subjects told who the family was or would be, nor were they given any other information about the family. Yet the group told that the family had already been selected gave substantially more. Paul Slavik, a leading researcher in this field, believes that the identifiable or even predetermined person appeals to us so much because we use two distinct processes for grasping reality and deciding what to do: the effective system and the deliberative system. The distinction was popularized by Daniel Kahneman in his 2011 bestseller, Thinking Fast and Slow. The effective system is grounded in our emotional responses. It works with images, real or metaphorical, and with stories, rapidly processing them to generate an intuitive feeling that something is right or wrong, good or bad. That feeling leads to immediate action. The deliberative system draws on our reasoning abilities rather than our emotions, and it works with words, numbers, and abstractions rather than with images and stories. These processes are conscious, and they require us to appraise logic and evidence. As a result, the deliberative system takes a little longer than the effective system and does not result in such immediate action. An individual in need tugs at our emotions. That's our affective system at work. Mother Teresa expressed this well. If I look at the mass, I will never act. If I looked at the one, I will. If we pause to think about it, we realize that the mass is made up of individuals, each with needs as pressing as the one. We also know that it's better to act to help that individual plus an additional individual than to help just the one. And even better to help those two individuals plus a third individual, and so on. We know that our deliberative system is right. Yet, for Mother Teresa, as for many others, this knowledge lacks the impact of something that tugs on our emotions the way a single needy person does. More evidence about the distinctive ways in which these two systems work comes from further experiments carried out by the same team that compared the responses of people given information about Rokia with those given more general information. This time, the researchers were investigating whether rousing the emotions of the research subjects would lead them to respond differently to the two kinds of information. Once again, the participants all completed a standard survey, and then one randomly selected group was given emotionally neutral questions, for example, math puzzles, while the other group was given questions designed to arouse their emotions. For example, when you hear the word baby, what do you feel? Then everyone was given the opportunity to donate some of their participation payment to a charity. But for half of each group, the information included Rokia only, while the other half was given the more general information about people in need. Those who had answered the emotionally arousing questions and received the information about Rokia gave almost twice as much as those who were given the same information but had responded to the emotionally neutral questions. But the amount given by those who received the general information was not significantly affected by the questions they had answered. Our response to the images and stories, and thus to identifiable victims, is dependent on our emotions. But our response to more abstract facts, conveyed in words and numbers, remains much the same, whatever the state of our emotions. Parochialism. 250 years ago, philosopher and economist Adam Smith invited his readers to reflect on their attitudes to distant strangers by asking them to imagine that the great empire of China, with all its myriads of inhabitants, was suddenly swallowed up by an earthquake. Consider, he then asked his readers, how a man of humanity in Europe, who had no special connection with that part of the world, would receive the news. Whatever that person might say, Smith contends, he would pursue his business or his pleasure, take his repose or his diversion with the same ease and tranquility as if no such accident had happened. The tragic earthquake that struck China's Sichuan province in 2008 showed that Smith's observation still holds. Though the earthquake killed 70,000 people, injured 350,000 people, and made nearly 5 million homeless, its impact on me was quite temporary. Reading about the deaths and seeing the devastation on television aroused my sympathy for the families of the victims, but I did not stop work, lose sleep, or even cease to enjoy the normal pleasures of life. No one I knew did. Our intellect, our deliberative system, takes in the news of the disaster, but our emotions are rarely disturbed by tragedies that occur to strangers far away, with whom we have no special connection. Even if we are moved to donate to emergency relief, hearing such terrible news does not change our lives in any fundamental way. At our best, we give far less to help foreigners than we give to those within our own country. The tsunami that struck Southeast Asia just after Christmas 2004 killed 220,000 people and rendered millions homeless and destitute. It prompted Americans to give $1.54 billion for disaster relief work, the largest amount that Americans have ever given after any natural disaster outside the United States. But it was less than a quarter of the $6.5 billion Americans gave the following year to help those affected by Hurricane Katrina, which killed about 1,600 people and left far fewer homeless than the tsunami. An earthquake in Pakistan in October 2005 that killed 73,000 people elicited a comparatively low $150 million in donations from Americans. The earthquake was the only one of these three tragic events that was not caught on video and so did not result in dramatic and oft-repeated television coverage. Bear in mind that the victims of the American disaster were also being helped by a government with far greater resources than the governments of the countries struck by the tsunami and the earthquake. Discomforting as our relative indifference to people in distant countries may be, it is easy to understand why we are like this. Our species has spent millions of years evolving as social mammals, with offspring who need their parents' care for many years. For most of these millions of years, parents who did not care for and help their children survive during this period of dependence were unlikely to pass on their genes. Hence, our concern for the welfare of others tends to be limited to our kin and to those with whom we are in cooperative relationships, and perhaps also to members of our own small tribal group. Even when nation-states formed and tribal ethics began to be superseded by the requirements of the larger entity, the intuition that we should help others usually extended only to helping our compatriots. In Bleak House, Charles Dickens lends his support to parochialism by ridiculing the telescopic philanthropy of Mrs. Jellyby, who could see nothing nearer than Africa. She dedicates herself to a project that aims to educate the natives of Biryabula Ga on the left bank of the Niger. But her house is a mess and her children are neglected. It was easy for Dickens to make fun of Mrs. Jellyby, for such philanthropy was, in his day, misguided. It was hard to know whether people far away needed our help. If they did, it was even harder to find effective ways of helping them. Anyway, there were many British poor in circumstances scarcely less desperate. In noting the limits to our sympathy for those far away, Adam Smith said that this state of affairs seems wisely ordered by nature. Since those far from us are people we can neither serve nor hurt, if we cared more, it would produce only anxiety to ourselves, without any manner of advantage to them. Today, these words are as absolute as the quill with which Smith wrote them. As a response to the tsunami vividly demonstrated, instant communications and air travel mean that we can help those far from us in ways that were impossible in Smith's day. In addition, the gap between the living standards of people in affluent countries and those in low-income countries has increased enormously, so that those of us living in industrialized countries have greater capacity to help those far away and greater reason to focus our aid on them. Far away is where the vast majority of the extremely poor are and where charitable dollars can go the farthest. Futility. In one study, people were told that there were several thousand refugees at risk in a camp in Rwanda and were asked how willing they were to send aid that would save the lives of 1,500 of them. In asking this question, the researchers varied the total number of people they said were at risk, but kept the number that the aid would save at 1,500. People turned out to be more willing to help to save 1,500 out of 3,000 people at risk than they were to help to save 1,500 out of 10,000 at risk. We seem to respond as if anything that leaves most of the people in the camp at risk is futile. Although, of course, for the 1,500 who will be saved by the aid, and for their families and friends, the rescue is anything but futile, irrespective of the total number in the camp. Paul Slovic, who co-authored this study, concludes that the proportion of lives saved often carries more weight than the number of lives saved. As a result, people will give more support for saving 80% of 100 lives at risk than for saving 20% of 1,000 lives at risk. In other words, for saving 80 lives rather than for saving 200 lives, even when the cost of saving each group is the same. Perhaps Gaetano Cipriano, who we met in Chapter 3, reveals an element of this way of thinking when he says, "I can't change the world, but I try to make my little corner of the world a little bit better every day." Cipriano is a wealthy man, but he can't really change Newark, New Jersey either. He can only help some of the poor there. Still, he can help a bigger proportion of the poor in Newark than of the world's poor. People say that donating to the poor is drops in the ocean, implying that it's not worth giving, because no matter how much we do, the ocean of people in need will seem just as vast as it was before. The high school students introduced in the previous chapter said, referring to poverty, "It's going to go on, and there will never be enough money to help all these people." These are all examples of what psychologists label futility thinking. The diffusion of responsibility. We are also much less likely to help someone if the responsibility for helping does not rest entirely on us. In a famous case that jolted the American psyche, Kitty Genovese, a young woman in Queens, New York, was brutally attacked and killed, while 38 people in different apartments reportedly saw or heard what was happening but did nothing to aid her. The revelation that so many people heard Genovese's screams but failed even to pick up the phone to call the police led to a national debate about what kind of people we have become. The public debate that followed the Kitty Genovese murder led psychologists John Daly and Beebe Latané to explore the phenomenon of diffusion of responsibility. They invited students to participate in a market research survey. The students went to an office where they were met by a young woman who told them to sit down and gave them some questionnaires to fill out. She then went into an adjacent room separated from the office only by a curtain. After a few minutes, the students heard noises suggesting that she had climbed on a chair to get something from a high shelf, and the chair had fallen over. She cried out, "Oh my God, my foot! I can't move it! Oh, my ankle! I can't get this thing off me!" The moaning and crying went on for about another minute. Of those students who were alone in the adjoining room filling out the market research survey, 70% offered to help. When another person, who appeared to be a student completing the survey, but was in fact a stooge, was also present, and that person did not respond to the calls for help, only 7% offered to help. Even when two genuine students were together in the room, the proportion offering to help was much lower than when there was only one student. The diffusion of responsibility had a marked inhibiting effect, the bystander effect. Other experiments have yielded similar results. The sense of fairness. Nobody likes being the only one cleaning up while everyone else stands around. In the same way, our willingness to help the poor can be reduced if we think that we would be doing more than our fair share. People considering giving a substantial portion of their disposable income can't help but be aware that others, including those with loads of disposable income, are not doing the same. Imagine that instead of traveling somewhere warm for your winter vacation, you decided to stay at home and use the money you would have spent on the vacation to donate to Helen Keller International's Vitamin A Supplementation Program, which is a very low-cost way of preventing blindness and reducing the risk of severe infections. Then you run into your neighbors and they tell you about the great time they had sailing and scuba diving in Grenada. Would that make you less likely to forgo your vacation next year so that you could donate? So strong is our sense of fairness that to prevent others from getting more than their fair share, we are often willing to take less for ourselves. In the ultimatum game, two players are told that one of them, the proposer, will be given a sum of money, say $10, and must divide it with the second player, the responder. But how the money is divided is up to the proposer, who can offer as much or as little as she wishes. If the responder rejects the offer, neither will get anything. The game is played only once, and the players' identities are not revealed. So their decisions will not be influenced by any sorts of payback if they should meet again. If the players acted purely from self-interest, the proposer would offer the smallest possible amount, and the responder would accept it, because after all, even a little is better than nothing at all. But across many different cultures, most proposers offer an equal split of the money. That offer is invariably accepted. Occasionally, however, proposers behave as economists would expect them to and offer less than 20%. Then most responders confound the economists by rejecting the offer. Even monkeys will reject a reward for a task if they see another monkey getting a better reward for performing the same task. Responders who reject small offers show that even when dealing with a complete stranger with whom they will never interact again, they would rather punish unfairness than gain money. Why would people and monkeys act in ways that seem contrary to their own interest? The most plausible answer is that moral intuitions like fairness developed because they enhanced the reproductive fitness of those who had them and the groups to which they belonged. Among social animals, those who form cooperative relationships tend to do much better than those who do not. By making a fair offer, you signal that you are the kind of person who would make a good partner for cooperating. Conversely, by rejecting an unfair offer, you show that you are not going to put up with getting a raw deal, and thus you deter others from trying to take advantage of you. There are also social advantages to such intuitions. A society in which most people act fairly will generally do better than one in which everyone is always seeking to take unfair advantage, because people will be better able to trust each other and form cooperative relationships. Psychology, evolution, and ethics. To many, the intuitions discussed in this chapter amount to a reasonable rejoinder, gathered under the general notion, it's not in our nature, to arguments for the moral necessity to give to the distant poor. And at first glance, the moral judgment that we should help the victim we can see rather than the victim we can't does feel right. If we think again, however, the intuition doesn't stand up to examination. Suppose that we are in a boat in a storm and we see two capsized yachts. We can either rescue one person clinging to one upturned yacht, or five people whom we cannot see but we know are trapped inside the other upturned yacht. We will have time to go to only one of the yachts before they're pounded onto the rocks, and most likely anyone clinging to or inside the yacht we do not go to will be drowned. We can identify the man who is alone. We know his name and what he looks like, although otherwise we know nothing about him and have no connection with him. We don't know anything about those trapped inside the other yacht, except that there are five of them. If we have no reason to think that the single identifiable victim is in any way more worthy of rescue than each of the five non-identifiable people, surely we should rescue the larger number of people. What's more, if we put ourselves in the position of the people needing to be rescued, but without knowing which of the six we are, we would want the rescuers to go to the capsized yacht with five people, because that will give us the best chance of being rescued. The same is true for each of the other four psychological factors we have investigated. Our parochial feelings are a restriction on our willingness to act on our capacity, both financial and technological, to give to those beyond the borders of our nation, and thereby to do much more good than we can do if our philanthropy stops at those borders. Bill Gates, the master of global technology, has understood and acted on the ethical implications of the fact that we are now one world. His philanthropy is primarily focused on doing the most good in the world as a whole. When asked by an interviewer for Forbes what advice he'd offer the next US president to improve American competitiveness and innovation, Gates batted the question straight back, saying, "I tend to think more about improving the entire world as opposed to relative positions." Otherwise, you could say, "Hey, World War II was great because the US was in its strongest relative position when that was over." Even less defensible than parochialism are the feelings of futility that lead us to focus on the number of people we cannot help rather than the number we can. The drops in the ocean response to the argument for giving aid overlooks the fact that my aid will help specific individuals, families, or even villages, and the good that I do for them is not lessened by the fact that there are many more needy people I cannot help. Others find intuitive appeal in the diffusion of responsibility. Thus, they believe that I have a stronger obligation to save the drowning child than to donate to provide bed nets that will save the lives of children who would otherwise die from malaria. Because I'm the only person in a position to save the drowning child, whereas a billion or more people could donate to provide bed nets. But even though at least a billion others could help the children who will be helped by your contribution, what difference does that make if you know that they won't? Or anyway, that not enough of them will, for all of the families in malaria-prone regions to be provided with nets. Patterns of behavior that helped our ancestors survive and reproduce may, in today's very different circumstances, be of no benefit to us or to our descendants. Even if some evolved intuition or way of acting was still conducive to our survival and reproduction, however, that would not, as Darwin himself recognized, make it right. Evolution has no moral direction. An evolutionary understanding of human nature can explain the differing intuitive responses we have when we are faced with an individual rather than with a mass of people, or with people close to us rather than with those far away. But it does not justify taking those feelings as a guide to what we ought to do. On the other hand, concluding that others' needs should count as much as our own is not the same as feeling it. And hence, we fail to respond to the needs of the world's poorest people as we would respond to someone in need of rescue right in front of us. Skeptics doubt that reason has any influence on whether we act ethically. It's all a matter of what we want or desire, they say, of what feels good or bad to us, of what we find attractive or repugnant. They deny that understanding or argument, in a word, the kind of thing that philosophers do, and of which this book largely consists, is ever going to lead anyone to action. I now have a growing collection of anecdotes that are difficult to reconcile with that view. I've already mentioned in chapter 3 Charlie Bresler's response to the first edition of this book and what happened as a result of that. Here are a few others who have responded to the ethical arguments I have put forward. In the same New York Times piece about global poverty that the Glenview High School students read, I included telephone numbers that readers could call to donate to UNICEF or Oxfam America. These organizations later told me that in the months after the article appeared, those phone lines brought in about $600,000 more than they usually took in. That's not a vast sum, given how many people read the New York Times on Sundays. Still, it does indicate that the article persuaded a significant number of people to give. Some of those donors have continued to do so. Several years after the article was published, I have been told someone came to the Oxfam office in Boston, took a carefully preserved copy of my article out of her bag, and told the staff that she had been meaning to give to the organization ever since reading it. She has since become a major donor. Kate Grant, the executive director of Fistula Foundation, one of the Life You Can Save's current recommended charities, has told me that many donors come to her organization as a result of reading my work. On one occasion, she wrote, "Next month, the young man who has given us a total of $700,000 will be traveling with me and our board to Kenya to see our hospital network there. He found us because of you." Dean Spears and his wife, Diane Coffey, were so impressed by reading my article, Famine, Affluence and Morality, that they read the story of the drowning child in the pond at their wedding. More significantly, instead of seeking academic jobs, the newlyweds went to live in India, where they started an organization called RISE, which stands for Research Institute for Compassionate Economics. The organization is dedicated to understanding the lives of poor people, especially young children, and to promoting their well-being. Dean and Diane began working on the problem of open defecation, then a neglected issue with, in his words, terrible and lasting consequences for early life health. They wrote a book on the topic called Where India Goes. Since then, RISE has broadened its work to include maternal nutrition, air pollution, and social inequality more generally. Chris Croy's ethics class at St. Louis Community College in Merrimack, Missouri, was told to read Famine, Affluence, and Morality, as well as a critique by the philosopher John Arthur, asserting that if my argument was sound, it wouldn't just require us to donate money to charities, but also to donate our kidneys, because that would also do a lot of good without causing comparable harm to the donor. Arthur thought that implication couldn't be right, and therefore my argument must be mistaken. Chris questioned that. Perhaps he really should donate a kidney to a stranger. He discussed it with a friend and thought about it for a long time before calling a hospital and eventually donating a kidney to whoever could use it most. Later he got a call from the grateful recipient, a school teacher at a school that served mostly poor children.